fear. All right, very good.
Ignoring Krasnikov's ongoing protests, Lazovsky turned his attention to the primly dressed associate and began giving her instructions. That she find scrubs for the team and a suitable place to wash. That she gather the necessary surgical tools. That she sterilize everything. The door swung open and a young man appeared, wearing the cavalier expression of one who has just come from a ball.
"Good evening, Comrade Lazovsky," he said with a smile. "What a charming place you have here."
"All right, Antonovich, that'll be enough of that. It's a fracture at the front of the left parietal bone, with a likely risk of subdural hematoma. Suit up, and see if you can do something about this lighting."
"Yes, sir."
"But first, get them out of here."
As Antonovich began corralling the two resident physicians out of the surgery with his carefree smile, Lazovsky pointed at the young nurse who had been manning the desk downstairs.
"Not you. Get yourself ready to assist."
Then he turned to the Count.
"Your daughter has taken quite a crack, Rostov, but she hasn't fallen headfirst from a plane. The skull was designed to withstand a certain amount of rough treatment. In these sorts of cases, the greatest risk is from swelling rather than direct damage. But that's nothing we haven't dealt with before. We're going to attend to your daughter immediately. In the meantime, you will need to sit outside. I will come and report to you as soon as I can."
The Count was led to a bench right outside the surgery. It took him a few moments to realize that in the preceding minutes the hallway had been cleared. The two gurneys with their sleeping patients were gone. The door at the end of the hallway suddenly swung open to admit Antonovich, who was now in scrubs and whistling. As the door swung closed, the Count could see that a man in a black suit had held the door open for him. When Antonovich went back into surgery 4, the Count was alone in the empty hallway. How did he spend the ensuing minutes? How would any man spend them? He prayed for the first time since childhood. He allowed himself to imagine the worst, then assured himself that everything would be all right, reviewing the surgeon's few remarks over and over. "The skull was designed for rough treatment," he repeated to himself. Yet against his will, he was visited by contrary examples. He recalled a genial woodsman from the village of Petrovskoye, for instance, who had been hit in the head in the prime of his life by a falling limb. When he regained consciousness, he was as strong as ever, but sullen. On occasion, he failed to recognize his friends, and without the slightest provocation, he could explode in anger toward his own sisters, as if he'd been put to bed one man and had risen from bed another. The Count began to chastise himself. How could he have let Sophia play such a reckless game? How could he while away an hour in a bar fretting over history paintings and statues, while fate was preparing to hold his daughter's life in the balance? For all the varied concerns attendant to the raising of a child, over schoolwork, dress, and manners, in the end, a parent's responsibility could not be more simple. To bring a child safely into adulthood so that she could have a chance to experience a life of purpose and, God willing, contentment. Untold minutes passed. The door to the surgery opened, and Dr. Lazovsky appeared. He had his mask pulled below his chin. His hands were bare, but there was blood on his smock. The Count leapt up.
"Please, Rostov," said the surgeon. "Have a seat."
The Count sat back on the bench. Lazovsky didn't join him. Rather, he put his fists on his hips and looked down at the Count with an unmistakable expression of competence.
"As I told you, in these situations, the greatest risk is swelling. We have alleviated that risk. Nonetheless, she has suffered a concussion, which is basically a bruising of the brain. She is going to have headaches and will need a good deal of rest, but in a week she will be up and about."
The surgeon turned to go. The Count extended a hand.
"Dr. Lazovsky," he said, in the manner of one who wishes to ask a question, yet suddenly can't find the means of doing so. But the surgeon, who had stood in this spot before, understood well enough.
She's going to be every bit herself, Rostov.
As the Count began to offer his thanks, the man in the black suit opened the door at the end of the hall once again. Only this time it was for Osip Glebnikov.
"Excuse me," said the surgeon to the Count.
Meeting halfway down the hall, Osip and Lazovsky conferred for a minute in lowered voices while the Count watched in astonishment. When the surgeon disappeared into the surgery, Osip joined the Count on the bench.
"Well, my friend," he said with his hands on his knees, "your little Sophia has given us quite a scare."
"Osip, what are you doing here?"
"I wanted to make sure that you were both all right."
"But how did you come to find us?"
Osip smiled. "As I've told you, Alexander, it is my business to keep track of certain men of interest. But that doesn't matter at the moment. What does matter is that Sophia's going to be fine. Lazovsky is the best surgeon in the city. Tomorrow morning he will be taking her to First Municipal, where she can recover in comfort. But I'm afraid that you can't stay here any longer." The Count began to protest, but Osip raised a calming hand. "Listen to me, Sasha. If I know what has happened tonight, others will soon know too, and it would not be in your best interest, or Sophia's for that matter, if they were to find you sitting here. So this is what you must do. There is a staircase at the end of this hall. You need to go down to the ground floor and through the black metal door, which leads to the alley behind the hospital. In the alley, there will be two men waiting who will take you back to the hotel."
"I can't leave Sophia," said the Count.
"You have to, I'm afraid. But your concern is perfectly understandable. So I have arranged for someone to stay with Sophia in your stead until she is ready to go home." At this remark, the door was opened to admit a middle-aged woman looking bewildered and frightened. It was Marina. Behind the seamstress was a matron in uniform.
"Ah," said Osip, standing. "Here she is."
Because Osip stood, Marina looked to him first. Having never seen him before, she met his gaze with anxiety. But then she saw the Count sitting on the bench and ran forward.
"Alexander, what has happened? What are you doing here? They wouldn't tell me a thing."
"It's Sophia, Marina. She had a bad fall on the service stairs of the hotel. But a surgeon is with her now. She's going to be all right."
"Thank God."
The Count turned to Osip as if he were about to introduce him, but Osip preempted.
"Comrade Samarova," he said with a smile. "We haven't met, but I too am a friend of Alexander's. I'm afraid that he needs to return to the Metropole. But it would be such a comfort to him if you could remain with Sophia until her recovery. Isn't that so, my friend?"
Osip laid a hand on the Count's shoulder without taking his gaze off Marina.
"But I know it is a great deal to ask, Marina," said the Count. "But
not another word, Alexander. Of course I will stay."
"Excellent," said Osip. He turned to the uniformed woman. "You'll see that Comrade Samarova receives everything that she requires?"
"Yes, sir."
Osip offered Marina one more reassuring smile and then took the Count by the elbow.
"This way, my friend."
Osip led the Count down the hall and into the back staircase. They descended a flight together without speaking, and then Osip stopped on the landing.
"This is where we part. Remember, down another flight and out the black metal door. Naturally, it would be best if you never mentioned to anyone that either of us were here."
"Osip, I don't know how to repay you."
"Alexander," he said with a smile, "you have been at my service for over 15 years. It is a pleasure for once to be at yours."
Then he was gone. The Count descended the last flight and went through the black metal door. It was nearly dawn and, despite finding himself in an alley,
The Count could sense the gentleness of spring in the air. Across the alley, there was a white van with the words Red Star Baking Collective painted in large letters on its side. An ill-shaven young man was leaning against the passenger door, smoking. When he saw the Count, he tossed his cigarette and thumped the door behind him. Without asking the Count who he was, he went behind the van and opened the rear door.
"Thank you," said the Count as he climbed inside, receiving no reply.
It was only when the door closed and the Count found himself bent over at the waist in the back of the van that he became aware of an extraordinary sensation, the smell of freshly baked bread. When he had seen the insignia of the baking collective, he had assumed it was a ruse. But on the shelves that ran along one side of the van were over 200 loaves in orderly arrangement. Gently, almost in disbelief, the Count reached out to lay a hand on one and found it to be soft and warm. It couldn't have been more than an hour from the oven. Outside, the passenger door slammed shut and the van's engine started. The Count quickly sat on the metal bench that faced the shelves, and they were underway. In the silence, the Count listened to the gears of the van shifting. Having sped up and slowed down as it came into and out of various turns, the van's engine now accelerated to the speed of an open road. Shuffling to the rear of the van with his back hunched, the Count looked out the little square window in the door. As he watched the buildings and canopies and shop signs flying past, for a moment he couldn't tell where he was. Then suddenly he saw the old English club, and realized that they must be on Tverskaya, the ancient road that radiated from the Kremlin in the direction of St. Petersburg, and that he had strolled 1,000 times before. In the late 1930s, Tverskaya Street had been widened to accommodate the official parades that ended in Red Square. While at the time some of the finer buildings had been lifted and set back, most had been raised and replaced with towers, in accordance with a new ordinance that buildings on first-rate streets stand at least 10 stories tall. As a result, the Count would have had to strain to pick out other familiar landmarks as the van moved along. But he had stopped looking for what was familiar, and instead was watching the blur of facades and street lamps receding rapidly from his view, as if they were being pulled into the distance. Back in the attic of the Metropole, the Count found his door still open and Montaigne on the floor. Picking up his father's book, the Count sat down on Sophia's bed. Then, for the first time that night, he let himself weep, his chest heaving lightly with the release. But if tears fell freely down his face, they were not tears of grief. They were the tears of the luckiest man in all of Russia. After a few minutes, the Count breathed deeply and felt a sense of peace. Realizing that his father's book was still in his hand, he rose from Sophia's bed to set it down. And that's when he saw the black leather case that had been left on the Grand Duke's desk. It was about a foot square and 6 inches high, with a handle in leather and clasps of chrome. Taped on top was a note addressed to him in an unfamiliar script. Pulling the note free, the Count unfolded it and read, "Alexander, what a pleasure meeting you tonight. As I mentioned, I am headed home for a spell. In the meantime, I thought you could make good use of this. You might pay special attention to the contents in the uppermost sleeve, as I think you will find it very apropos of our chat. With warm regards till next we meet. Richard Vanderwyl." Throwing the clasps, the Count opened the lid of the case. It was a portable phonograph. Inside there was a small stack of records in brown paper sleeves. Per Richard's suggestion, the Count singled out the uppermost disc. On the label at the center, it was identified as a recording of Vladimir Horowitz playing Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto at Carnegie Hall in New York. The Count had seen Horowitz perform in Moscow in 1921, less than 4 years before the pianist travelled to Berlin for an official concert, with a wad of foreign currency tucked in his shoes. At the back of the case, the Count found a small compartment in which the electrical cord was folded away. Unravelling it, he plugged the player into the wall socket. He removed the record from its sleeve, placed it on the turntable, threw the switch, cued the needle, and sat back on Sophia's bed. At first, he heard muted voices, a few coughs, and the last rustlings of an audience settling in. Then silence. Then heartfelt applause as the performer presumably took the stage. The Count held his breath. After the trumpets sounded their first martial notes, the strings swelled, and then his countryman began to play, evoking for the American audience the movement of a wolf through the birches, the wind across the steppe, the flicker of a candle in a ballroom, and the flash of a cannon at Borodino. Addendum. On the 23rd of June, at 4 in the afternoon, André Duras was riding the bus back to his apartment in the Arbat, having taken advantage of his day off to visit Sophia at First Municipal Hospital. The next day, he looked forward to reporting at the daily meeting of the Triumvirate that she was in good spirits. Housed in a special wing of the hospital, she had a private room full of sunlight and constant attention from a battalion of nurses. Emile would be pleased to learn that his cookies were well received and that Sophia promised to send word the minute she had run out. While for his part, André had brought a book of adventure stories that had always been a favourite of his son's. At Smolenskaya Square, André gave his seat to an older woman. He would be disembarking in a few blocks anyway, to get some cucumbers and potatoes at the peasant market in the square. Emile had given him 1/2 pound of minced pork, and he was going to make cotlette for his wife. André and his wife lived in a narrow 4-story apartment building in the middle of the block. Theirs was one of the smallest of the 16 apartments, but they had it to themselves, at least for now. Having completed his errand at the market, André climbed the stairs to the 3rd floor. As he passed the other doors along the hallway, he could smell onions being sautéed in one apartment and hear voices on the radio in another. Shifting the bag of groceries to his left arm, he took out his key. Letting himself inside, André called out to his wife, though he knew she wouldn't be home. She would be waiting in line at the new milk store that had opened in a decommissioned church on the other side of the neighbourhood. She said the milk there was fresher and the line was shorter, but André knew this wasn't true. Like so many others, she went there because the small chapel at the back of the church had a mosaic of Christ and the woman at the well that no one had bothered to dismantle. And the women who waited in line for their milk were willing to hold your place while you slipped away to pray. André carried his groceries into the little room overlooking the street, which served as both kitchen and sitting room. On the small counter, he laid out the vegetables. After washing his hands, he washed the cucumbers and sliced them. He peeled the potatoes and put them in a pot of water. He mixed the meat from Emile with chopped onion, formed the cotlette, and covered them with a towel. He put the frying pan on the stove and poured in some oil for later. Having cleared off the counter, he washed his hands again, set the table, and then went down the hallway with the intention of lying down. But without quite thinking about it, he passed their bedroom door and went into the next room. Many years before, André had visited Pushkin's apartment in St. Petersburg, the one where he'd lived in his final years. The rooms of the apartment had been preserved just as they'd been on the day the poet died. There was even an unfinished poem and pen sitting on the desk. At the time, standing behind the little rope and gazing at the poet's desk, André had thought the whole venture rather preposterous, as if by keeping a few belongings in place one might actually protect a moment from the relentless onslaught of time. But when Ilya, their only child, was killed in the Battle of Berlin, just months before the end of the war, he and his wife had done the same thing, leaving every blanket, every book, every piece of clothing, exactly where it had been on the day that they'd received the news. Initially, Andre had to admit, this had been a great comfort. When he was alone in the apartment, he would find himself visiting the room. And when he did so, he could see from the depression on the bed where his wife must have been sitting while he was at work. Now, though, he worried that this carefully preserved room had begun to sustain, rather than alleviate, their grief. And he knew the time had come for them to rid themselves of their son's belongings. Though he knew this, he didn't raise the matter with his wife, for he also knew that soon enough, someone in the building would draw the attention of the housing authorities to their son's death. Then they would be moved to an even smaller apartment, or required to take in a stranger, and life would reclaim the room as its own. But even as he had this thought, Andre walked over to the bed and smoothed out the blankets where his wife had been sitting, and only then did he turn out the light. Book 4. 1950. Adagio, Andante, Allegro. In the blink of an eye. That was how, on the 21st of June, Count Alexander Rostov summed up his daughter's journey from 13 to 17, when Vasily remarked on how much she had grown. One moment she is scampering up and down the stairwells, a veritable gadabout, a gadfly, a ne'er-do-well, and the next she is a young woman of intelligence and refinement. And this was largely true, for if the Count had been premature in characterizing Sophia as demure when she was 13, he had perfectly anticipated her persona on the cusp of adulthood. With fair skin and long black hair, but for the white stripe that fell from the spot of her old injury, Sophia could sit for hours listening to music in their study. She could stitch for hours with Marina in the stitching room, or chat for hours with Emil in the kitchen without shifting once in her chair. When Sophia was just 5, the Count had assumed, naively perhaps, that she would grow up to be a dark-haired version of her mother. But while Sophia shared Nina's clarity of perception and confidence of opinion, she was entirely different in demeanour. Where her mother was prone to express her impatience with the slightest of the world's imperfections, Sophia seemed to presume that if the earth spun awry upon occasion, it was generally a well-intentioned planet. And where Nina would not hesitate to cut someone off in mid-assertion in order to make a contrary point, and then declare the matter decided once and for all, Sophia would listen so attentively and with such a sympathetic smile that her interlocutor, having been given free rein to express his views at considerable length, often found his voice petering out as he began to question his own premises. Demure. That was the only word for it. And the transition had occurred in the blink of an eye.
When you reach our age, Vasily, it all goes by so quickly. Whole seasons seem to pass without leaving the slightest mark on our memory.
How true, agreed the concierge, as he sorted through an allotment of tickets.
But surely there is a comfort to be taken from that, continued the Count. For even as the weeks begin racing by in a blur for us, they are making the greatest of impressions upon our children. When one turns 17 and begins to experience that first period of real independence, one's senses are so alert, one's sentiment so finely attuned that every conversation, every look, every laugh may be writ indelibly upon one's memory. And the friends that one happens to make in those impressionable years? One will meet them forever after with a welling of affection.
Having expressed this paradox, the Count happened to look across the lobby, where Grisha was lugging the luggage of one guest toward the front desk as Genya lugged the luggage of another toward the door.
"Perhaps it is a matter of celestial balance," he reflected. "A sort of cosmic equilibrium. Perhaps the aggregate experience of time is a constant, and thus for our children to establish such vivid impressions of this particular June, we must relinquish our claims upon it."
"So that they might remember, we must forget," Vasily summed up.
"Exactly," said the Count. "So that they might remember, we must forget. But should we take umbrage at the fact? Should we feel shortchanged by the notion that their experiences for the moment may be richer than ours? I think not. For it is hardly our purpose at this late stage to log a new portfolio of lasting memories. Rather, we should be dedicating ourselves to ensuring that they taste freely of experience. And we must do so without trepidation. Rather than tucking in blankets and buttoning up coats, we must have faith in them to tuck and button on their own. And if they fumble with their newfound liberty, we must remain composed, generous, judicious. We must encourage them to venture out from under our watchful gaze, and then sigh with pride when they pass at last through the revolving doors of life."
As if to illustrate, the Count gestured generously and judiciously toward the hotel's entrance, while giving an exemplary sigh. Then he tapped the concierge's desk.
"By the way, do you happen to know where she is?"
Vasily looked up from his tickets.
"Miss Sophia?"
"Yes.
She is in the ballroom with Victor, I believe."
"Ah, she must be helping him polish the floors for an upcoming banquet."
"No, not Victor Ivanovich. Victor Stepanovich."
"Victor Stepanovich?"
"Yes, Victor Stepanovich Skedovsky. The conductor of the orchestra at the piazza."
If in part the Count had been trying to express to Vasily how in our golden years a passage of time can be so fleet and leave so little an impression upon our memory that it is almost as if it never occurred, well then, here was a perfect example. For the 3 minutes it took the Count to travel from a delightful conversation at the concierge's desk to the ballroom, where he had grabbed a scoundrel by the lapels, had also passed in the blink of an eye. Why, it had passed so quickly that the Count did not remember knocking the luggage from Grisha's grip as he marched down the hall, nor did he remember throwing open the door and shouting, "Aha!" nor yanking the would-be Casanova up off the love seat, where he had intertwined his fingers with Sophia's. No, the Count did not remember any of it. But to ensure a celestial balance and the equilibrium of the cosmos, this mustachioed scoundrel in evening clothes was sure to remember every single second for the rest of his life.
"Your Excellency," he implored, as he dangled in the air, "there has been a terrible misunderstanding."
Looking up at the startled face above his fists, the Count confirmed that there had been no misunderstanding. It was definitely the very same fellow who waved his baton so blithely on the bandstand in the piazza. And though he apparently knew how to produce an honorific in a timely fashion, he was clearly as villainous a viper as had ever slithered from the underbrush of Eden. But whatever his level of villainy, the current situation did pose a quandary. For once you have hoisted a scoundrel by the lapels, what are you to do with him? At least, when you have a fellow by the scruff of the neck, you can carry him out the door and toss him down the stairs. But when you have him by the lapels, he isn't so easy to dispense with. Before the Count could solve his conundrum, Sophia expressed a conundrum of her own.
"Papa, what are you doing?"
"Go to your room, Sophia. This gentleman and I have a few matters to discuss, before I give him the drubbing of a lifetime."
"The drubbing of a lifetime? But Victor Stepanovich is my instructor."
Keeping one eye on the scoundrel, the The Count glanced at his daughter with the other.
Ill what? My instructor. He is teaching me piano.
The so-called instructor nodded four times in quick succession. Without releasing his hold on the cad's lapels, the Count leaned his head back so that he could study the mise-en-scene with a little more care. Upon closer inspection, the love seat the two had been sitting on did, in fact, appear to be the bench of a piano, and in the spot where their hands had been intertwined, there was an orderly row of ivory keys. The Count tightened his grip.
So that's your game, is it? Seducing young women with jitterbugs?
The so-called instructor looked aghast.
Absolutely not, Your Excellency. I have never seduced a soul with a jitterbug. We have been playing scales and sonatas. I myself trained at the conservatory, where I received the Mussorgsky medal. I only conduct in the restaurant in order to make ends meet.
Taking advantage of the Count's hesitation, he gestured toward the piano with his head.
Let us show you. Sophia, why don't you play the nocturne that we have been practicing?
The nocturne?
As you wish, Viktor Stepanovich,
Sophia replied politely, then turned to the keyboard in order to arrange her sheet music.
Perhaps,
the instructor said to the Count, with another nod toward the piano,
if I could just...
Oh, said the Count. Yes, of course.
The Count set him back on the ground and gave his lapels a quick brushing. Then the instructor joined his student on the bench.
All right, Sophia.
Straightening her posture, Sophia laid her fingers on the keys. Then, with the utmost delicacy, she began to play. At the sound of the first measure, the Count took two steps back.
Were those eight notes familiar to him? Did he recognize them in the least?
Why, he would have known them if he hadn't seen them in 30 years, and they happened to enter his compartment on a train. He would have known them if he bumped into them on the streets of Florence at the height of the season. In a word, he would have known them anywhere. It was Chopin, Opus 9, Number 2, in E-flat major. As she completed the first iteration of the melody in a perfect pianissimo and transitioned to the second with its suggestion of rising emotional force, the Count took another two steps back and found himself sitting in a chair. Had he felt pride in Sophia before? Of course he had. On a daily basis. He was proud of her success in school, of her beauty, of her composure, of the fondness with which she was regarded by all who worked in the hotel. And that is how he could be certain that what he was experiencing at that moment could not be referred to as pride. For there is something knowing in the state of pride.
Look, it says, didn't I tell you how special she is? How bright, how lovely. Well, now you can see it for yourself.
But in listening to Sophia play Chopin, the Count had left the realm of knowing and entered the realm of astonishment. On one level, he was astonished by the revelation that Sophia could play the piano at all. On another, that she tackled the primary and subordinate melodies with such skill. But what was truly astonishing was the sensitivity of her musical expression. One could spend a lifetime mastering the technical aspects of the piano and never achieve a state of musical expression. That alchemy by which the performer not only comprehends the sentiments of the composer, but somehow communicates them to her audience through the manner of her play. Whatever personal sense of heartache Chopin had hoped to express through this little composition, whether it had been prompted by a loss of love, or simply the sweet anguish one feels when witnessing a mist on a meadow in the morning, it was right there, ready to be experienced to its fullest, in the ballroom of the Hotel Metropole, 100 years after the composer's death. But how, the question remained, could a 17-year-old girl achieve this feat of expression, if not by channeling a sense of loss and longing of her own? As Sophia began the third iteration of the melody, Viktor Stepanovich looked over his shoulder with his eyebrows raised as if to say,
Can you believe it? have you ever in all your years even imagined?
Then he quickly looked back to the piano and dutifully turned the page for Sophia, almost in the manner of an apprentice turning the page for his master. After the Count had led Viktor Stepanovich into the hall, where they could confer for a moment in private, he returned to the ballroom. Finding Sophia still at the piano, he took a seat at her side with his back to the keys. They were both silent.
"Why didn't you tell me you were studying piano?" the Count asked after a moment. "I wanted it to be a surprise," she said. "For your birthday. I didn't mean to upset you. I'm so sorry if I did."
"Sophia, if anyone should be apologizing, it should be me. You have done nothing wrong. On the contrary, that was wonderful, and unambiguously so."
Sophia blushed and looked down at the keyboard.
"It is a lovely composition," she said.
"Well, yes," agreed the Count with a laugh. "It is a lovely composition. But it is also a piece of paper with circles, lines, and dots. Nearly every student of piano for a century has learned to play that little bit of Chopin. But for most of them, it is an act of recitation. Only 1 in 1,000, or even 100,000, can bring the music to life, as you just have."
Sophia continued to look at the keyboard. The Count hesitated. And then, with a touch of trepidation, he asked,
"Is everything all right?"
Sophia looked up, a little surprised. Then, seeing how grave her father's expression was, she smiled.
"Of course, Papa. Why do you ask?"
The Count shook his head.
"I've never played an instrument in my life, but I understand something of music. To have played the opening measures of that piece with feeling so perfectly evocative of heartache, one can only assume that you have drawn on some wellspring of sorrow within yourself."
"Oh, I see," she said.
Then, with the enthusiasm of a young scholar, she began to explain.
"Viktor Stepanovich calls that the mood. He says that before one plays a note, one must discover an example of the composition's mood hidden away in one's heart. So, for this piece, I think about my mother. I think of how my few memories of her seem to be fading, and then I begin to play."
The Count was quiet, overwhelmed by another wave of astonishment.
"Does that make sense?"
Sophia asked.
"Abundantly," he said.
Then, after a moment of reflection, he added,
"As a younger man, I used to feel the same way about my sister. Every year that passed, it seemed a little more of her had slipped away, and I began to fear that one day I would come to forget her altogether. But the truth is, no matter how much time passes, those we have loved never slip away from us entirely."
They were both quiet now. Then, looking about him, the Count gestured with his hand.
"This was a favourite room of hers."
"Of your sister's?"
"No, no. Of your mother's."
Sophia looked around with some surprise.
"The ballroom?"
"Most definitely. After the revolution, all the old ways of doing things were abandoned. Which was the point, I suppose. But the new ways of doing things had yet to be established. So, all across Russia, all manner of groups, trade unions, citizens' committees, commissariats, gathered in rooms like this one in order to hash things out."
The Count pointed to the balcony.
"When your mother was 9, she would crouch up there behind the balustrade to watch these assemblies for hours on end. She found it all very thrilling, the shuffling of chairs and the heartfelt speeches and the pounding of the gavel. And, in retrospect, she was perfectly right. After all, a new course for the country was being charted right before our eyes. But, at the time, what with the crawling and the hunching,
It just gave me a crick in the neck.
You would go up there too?
Oh, she insisted. The Count and Sophia both smiled.
Come to think of it,
added the Count after a moment, that's how I came to know your Aunt Marina, because every other visit to the balcony, I'd split the seat of my pants. Sophia laughed. Then the Count wagged a finger in the manner of one who has remembered something else.
Later, when your mother was 13 or 14, she would come here to enact experiments.
Experiments?
Your mother was not one to take anything on faith. If she hadn't witnessed a phenomenon with her own eyes, then as far as she was concerned, it was a hypothesis, and that included all the laws of physics and mathematics. One day, I found her here testing the principles of Galileo and Newton by dropping various objects from the balcony and timing their descent with a sprinter's watch.
Is that even possible?
It was for your mother.
They were quiet for another moment. Then Sophia turned and kissed the Count on the cheek. When Sophia had gone off to meet a friend, the Count went to the piazza and treated himself to a glass of wine with lunch, something that he had done on a daily basis in his 30s and had rarely done since. Given the morning's revelations, it seemed only appropriate. In fact, when his plate had been cleared and he had dutifully declined dessert, he ordered a second glass. As he leaned back with his wine in hand, he regarded the young man at the neighbouring table, who was sketching in his sketchbook. The Count had noticed him in the lobby the day before with a book in his lap and a small tin of coloured pencils at his side. The Count leaned a little to his right.
Landscape? Portrait? Or still life?
The young man looked up with a touch of surprise.
Excuse me?
I couldn't help but notice you sketching away. I was just wondering if it was a landscape, a portrait, or a still life.
None of the above, I'm afraid, the young man replied politely.
It is an interior.
Of the restaurant?
Yes.
May I see?
The young man hesitated, then handed the Count his book. As soon as the Count had it in hand, he regretted his reference to sketching. The word hardly did justice to the young man's skills as an artist, for he had captured the piazza perfectly. The guests at the tables were rendered with the short, bright strokes of impressionism, adding to the sense that they were engaged in lively conversations, while the waiters, moving deftly between the tables, were rendered in something of a blur. But the suggestive style with which the young man had drawn the people was sharply contrasted by the level of detail with which he had drawn the room itself. The columns, the fountain, the arches were all realized in perfect perspective to perfect proportion, with every ornament in place.
"It's a wonderful drawing," said the Count, "but I must say your sense of space is particularly exquisite."
The stranger smiled a little wistfully. "That's because I'm an architect by training, not an artist."
"Are you designing a hotel?"
The architect gave a laugh. "The way things stand, I'd be happy to design a birdhouse." Given the Count's expression of curiosity, the young man elaborated. "For the time being, there are a lot of buildings being built in Moscow, but little need for architects. So I have taken a job with Interis. They're putting together a brochure of the city's finer hotels, and I'm drawing the interiors." What sort of topsy-turvy circumstances could lead to a boom for builders and a bust for architects?
Simple.
In January, the mayor of Moscow had called a convention of the city's architects to discuss the needs of the capital, given the rapid growth in its population. Over the course of 3 days, an excited consensus had quickly formed across the various committees that the time had come for bold new steps. Taking advantage of the latest materials and technologies, they proposed that the city erect towers 40 stories high with elevators that shot from the lobby to the roof,
and apartments that could be configured to suit every individual need, each with a modern kitchen and private bath and plate glass windows emitting natural light. At the closing ceremony of the convention, the mayor, a bald and brutish sort, whom we will have reason to revisit later, thanked the attendees for their artistry, their ingenuity, and their dedication to the party.
"It is satisfying to discover that we are all in agreement," he concluded. "In order to house our fellow comrades as quickly and economically as possible, we must, indeed, pursue bold new steps. So, let us not get bogged down with elaborate designs or bow to aesthetic vanities. Let us apply ourselves instead to a universal ideal that is fitting for our times."
Thus was born the golden age of the prefabricated, cement-walled, five-story apartment building, and the 400-square-foot living spaces with ready access to communal bathrooms boasting 4-foot tubs. After all, who has time to lie down in a bath when your neighbours are knocking at the door? So ingenious was the design of these new apartment buildings, so intuitive their architecture, they could be built from a single page of specifications, regardless of which way the page was oriented. Within 6 months, thousands of them had sprung up on the outskirts of Moscow, like mushrooms after a rain. And so systematic was their realization, you could mistakenly enter any apartment on your block and feel immediately at home.
"Ah," said the Count, "because a photograph cannot capture the feeling of a place."
"Actually," replied the architect, "because a photograph too readily captures the condition of a place."
"Oh, I see,"
said the Count, feeling a little insulted on the piazza's behalf. In its defence, he couldn't help pointing out that while the restaurant had been celebrated for its elegance in its time, the room's grandeur had never been defined by its furnishings or architectural details. "By what, then?" the young man asked.
"The citizenry."
"How do you mean?" The Count turned his chair so that he could better face his neighbour.
"In my day, I had the luxury of doing a good bit of travel, and I can tell you from personal experience that the majority of hotel restaurants, not simply in Russia, you understand, but across Europe, were designed for and have served the guests of the hotel. But this restaurant wasn't and hasn't. It was designed to be and has been a gathering place for the entire city of Moscow."
The Count gestured toward the center of the room.
"For most of the last 40 years, on a typical Saturday night, you could find Russians cut from every cloth crowded around that fountain, stumbling into conversations with whosoever happened to be at the neighbouring table. Naturally, this has led to impromptu romances and heartfelt debates on the merits of Pushkin over Petrarch. Why, I've watched cabbies rub elbows with commissars, and bishops with black marketeers. And on at least one occasion, I've actually seen a young lady change an old man's point of view."
The Count pointed to a spot about 20 feet away.
"You see those two tables there? One afternoon in 1939, I watched as two strangers, finding each other vaguely familiar, spent their appetizer, entree, and dessert, going over their entire lives, step by step, in search of the moment when they must have met."
Looking around the restaurant with renewed appreciation, the architect observed, "I suppose a room is the summation of all that has happened inside it."
"Yes, I think it is," agreed the Count. "And though I'm not exactly sure what has come of all the intermingling in this particular room, I am fairly certain that the world has been a better place because of it."
The Count was quiet for a moment, as he too looked around. Then, pointing a finger, he directed the architect's attention to the bandstand on the far side of the room.
"Have you ever happened to see the orchestra play here in the evening?"
"No, I haven't. Why?"
The most extraordinary thing happened to me today. Apparently, he was walking down the hallway when he happened to hear a Mozart variation emanating from the ballroom. Intrigued, he poked his head inside and discovered Sophia at the keyboard.
"No!" exclaimed Richard van der Waal.
Naturally, the fellow asked where she was studying. He was taken aback to learn that she hadn't been studying with anyone. She had taught herself to play the piece by listening to one of the recordings you had given me, and then sounding out the notes one by one.
Incredible!
The fellow was so impressed with her natural abilities that he took her on as a student right then and there, and he has been teaching her the classical repertoire in the ballroom ever since.
And this is the chap from the piazza, you say?
None other.
The one who waves the baton?
The very same.
Richard shook his head in wonder.
Odrius, have you heard all of this?
We've got to raise a glass to the young lady, and as soon as possible. 2 goldenrods, my good man.
The ever-attentive tender at bar was already lining up bottles of various sizes, including yellow chartreuse, bitters, honey, and a vodka infused with lemon. On that night in 1946, when the Count and Richard had first become acquainted over Odrius's magenta concoction, the American had challenged the bartender to design a cocktail in each of the colours of St. Basil's Cathedral. Thus were born the goldenrod, the robin's egg, the brick wall, and a dark green potion called the Christmas tree. In addition, it had become generally known in the bar that anyone who could drink all 4 cocktails back to back earned the right to be called the Patriarch of all Russia, as soon as he regained consciousness. Though Richard, who was now attached to the State Department, tended to stay at the embassy when in Moscow, he would still stop by the Metropole on occasion in order to have a nightcap with the Count. Thus, the goldenrods were poured, and the 2 gentlemen clinked their glasses with a toast to old friends. Some might wonder that the 2 men should consider themselves to be old friends, having only known each other for 4 years. But the tenure of friendships has never been governed by the passage of time. These 2 would have felt like old friends had they met just hours before. To some degree, this was because they were kindred spirits, finding ample evidence of common ground and cause for laughter in the midst of effortless conversation. But it was also almost certainly a matter of upbringing. Raised in grand homes in cosmopolitan cities, educated in the liberal arts, graced with idle hours, and exposed to the finest things, though the Count and the American had been born 10 years and 4,000 miles apart, they had more in common with each other than they had with the majority of their own countrymen. This, of course, is why the grand hotels of the world's capitals all look alike. The Plaza in New York, the Ritz in Paris, Claridge's in London, the Metropole in Moscow. Built within 15 years of each other, they too were kindred spirits. The first hotels in their cities with central heating, with hot water and telephones in the rooms, with international newspapers in the lobbies, international cuisine in the restaurants, and American bars off the lobby. These hotels were built for the likes of Richard van der Waal and Alexander Rostov, so that when they travelled to a foreign city, they would find themselves very much at home and in the company of kin.
"I still can't believe it's that fellow from the piazza," said Richard, with another shake of the head.
"I know," said the Count. "But he actually studied at the conservatory here in Moscow, where he was the recipient of the Mussorgsky Medal. He only conducts at the piazza in order to make ends meet."
"One must make ends meet," confirmed Odrius, matter-of-factly.
"Or meet one's end."
Richard studied the bartender for a moment.
"Well, that's the very essence of it, isn't it?"
Odrius shrugged, acknowledging that the essence of it was a bartender's stock in trade, and then he excused himself to answer the phone behind the bar. As he walked away, the Count seemed particularly struck by the bartender's remark.
"Are you familiar with the Moths of Manchester?"
he asked Richard.
"The Moths of Manchester. Isn't that a soccer team?"
"No,"
said the Count with a smile.
"It is not a soccer team. It is an extraordinary case from the annals of the natural sciences that my father related to me as a child."
But before the Count could elaborate, Odrius returned.
"That was your wife on the phone, Mr. van der Waal. She asked me to remind you of your appointment in the morning, and to alert you that your driver is waiting outside."
Though most of the customers in the bar had never met Mrs. van der Waal, she was known to be as unflappable as Arcady, as attentive as Odrius, and as aware of whereabouts as Vasily, when it came to drawing Mr. van der Waal's evenings to a close.
"Ah, yes," conceded Mr. van der Waal. Agreeing that duty comes first, the Count and Mr. van der Waal shook hands and wished each other well till next they met.
When Richard left, the Count looked once around the room to see if there was anyone he knew, and was pleased to discover that the young architect from the piazza was at a table in the corner, bent over his sketchbook, presumably rendering the bar. "He, too," thought the Count, "is one of the Moths of Manchester." When the Count was 9 years old, his father had sat him down in order to explain Darwin's theory of natural selection. As the Count listened, the essence of the Englishman's idea seemed perfectly intuitive. That over tens of thousands of years, a species would slowly evolve in order to maximize its chances of survival. After all, if the claws of the lion grow sharper, the gazelle had best grow more fleet of foot. But what had disconcerted the Count was when his father clarified that natural selection didn't need tens of thousands of years to take place. It didn't even need 100. It had been observed unfolding over the course of a few decades. It was true, his father said, that in a relatively static environment, the pace of evolution should decelerate, as individual species have little new to adapt to. But environments are never static for long. The forces of nature inevitably unleash themselves in such a manner that the necessity for adaptation will be stirred. An extended drought, an unusually cold winter, a volcanic eruption, any one of these could alter the balance between those traits that improve a species' chance for survival and those that hinder it. In essence, this is what had occurred in Manchester, England, in the 19th century, when the city became one of the first capitals of the Industrial Revolution. For thousands of years, the peppered moths of Manchester had white wings with black flecking. This colouring provided the species with perfect camouflage whenever they landed on the light grey bark of the region's trees. In any generation there might be a few aberrations, such as moths with pitch-black wings, but they were snapped off the trees by the birds before they had a chance to mate. But when Manchester became crowded with factories in the early 1800s, the soot from the smokestacks began to settle on every conceivable surface, including the bark of the trees. And the lightly speckled wings that had served to protect the majority of peppered moths suddenly exposed them remorselessly to their predators, even as the darker wings of the aberrations rendered them invisible. Thus, the pitch-black varieties that had represented less than 10% of the Manchester moth population in 1800 represented over 90% by the end of the century. Or so explained the Count's father, with the pragmatic satisfaction of the scientifically minded. But the lesson did not sit well with the young Count. If this could happen so easily to moths, he thought, then what was to stop it from happening to children? What would happen to him and his sister, for instance, should they be exposed to excess chimney smoke or sudden extremes of weather? Couldn't they become victims of accelerated evolution? In fact, so disconcerted by this notion became the Count
that when Idle Hour was deluged by rainstorms that September, giant black moths harrowed his dreams. Some years later, the Count would come to understand that he had been looking at the matter upside down. The pace of evolution was not something to be frightened by.